lost its fur named Chops, and Murray, a plump guinea pig that had just cut a foot and left red fleur-de-lis rodent prints all over the New York Times in the bottom of its cage. The family also had two cats. They were complete and unimpaired. Chisholm fixed breakfast, a large mound of secret ingredient, forgot what went in, scrambled eggs, link sausage, muffins, melon, milk. The fellow talks, or he doesn't talk. That is, he talks intensely, or is intensely silent. He is the noisiest silent man I've ever known. That morning, Chisholm was talking, something he does well. He planned to become a Mormon preacher before he lost the call. I'm writing a film treatment for a Western about Asa T. Sewell, a man who gave Rochester a baseball team, he said. In his day, Sewell was to Rochester, Kodak and Xerox combined. He manufactured patent medicines. The big seller was Hop Bitters, which he claimed to be, I'm quoting, the greatest blood purifier, liver regulator, and life and health restoring agent on earth. He also made the Indian cough cure, autumn leaf extract for females, ocean weed heart remedy, and swamp root. Became preposterously rich. Some people even got well taking Sewell's concoctions. Be all that as it may, what do you want to do? Don't entertain me. I have to build my stone retaining wall. Let's build it then. We began. There was nothing but an eroded bank, and the stones were still in the creek, on the hills, in the woods. We rolled, pushed, shoved, and piled rocks along the road, then loaded them into the back of his Fiat wagon. It was hot, and tent caterpillars swarmed the ground like the Chinese army, and bees hummed in the horse chestnut blossoms. While we worked, Chisholm talked. A friend who collected and drove nothing but Studebakers got rear-ended by a man admiring the old car. Harold Outhouse had a dog that could pull a bull down by the nose. A black family once moved out here and began building a home before being run off, although the area had been a stop on the Underground Railroad. A young woman ran past in her Dodge, covering us with dust, and I asked what the hell was going on. She's been living hidden away up this little road all her life. She's judgmental and vicious, and has it in for what she doesn't understand, which is almost everything. The pulling and hoisting and sweating stretched out the kinks of sitting behind a steering wheel. I couldn't recall labor feeling so good. Chisholm rolled a fat round stone out of the trees. I grabbed and pulled. I was capable of lifting it, but it was so close to the limits of my strength I didn't want to try. Working with someone I knew less well, I would have picked it up, but with this old friend I could concede my limit and let the boulder take my measure. Nothing showed our friendship better than that rock I walked away from. Chisholm picked it up, tottered, and bounced it in the Fiat. Then he dragged an even bigger hunk out of the creek. He was getting curious about what size stone he could lift. This one was too risky. Don't pull that Atlas routine again. Let me help. But he bent around the granite like a question mark and put it in. We dumped the stones in front of the embankment, then quit for lunch. There was little talk. Mostly we poured down iced tea and hung in our chairs like damp rags. At 2 o'clock we started again. Laying the stones was easier. Then a strange thing began to happen. We could feel an urging in the rocks, a behest to be put in just so, to be set where they would hold against the shifts of the earth, against the twists of the roots. They fit one way and not other ways. It was as if the stones were, as Indians believed, alive. The rocks were moving us. Are you a determinist? I said. How can a man live in this country and be a determinist? Neither am I. But this wall is proof, if you ever change your mind. It knows where it has to go. We aren't the ones making the decisions. Chisholm stopped. I felt it too. We just followed the will of the wall, whatever came from the stones, and the raw, eroded bank began to pull its cover of rock over. We worked like men possessed, Chisholm with a fever, I more slowly as I paused to watch him, to watch the sweat bead and drip through his beard. The dust stuck to us, and we smelled more of soil than men. We couldn't quit. My legs were turning to noodles, my hands cramping, and we began to drop stones. but we worked on. When the light came in low under the trees, we straightened to look. No more granite. We had laid 20 feet. Chisholm wanted to wash the stones, to clean them, to set them, and he should have. It was his wall. He had worked harder. But I, an opportunist, got the hose first. Grit and dust flushed from the rocks, the round ones shining like men's skulls, the flat ones like their tombstones. The wall would be there until other men came, and with effort, moved it. Maybe nothing else here I had done or would do would last as long as that wall. In the evening, fireflies switched on and off, crickets tweedled, and Caitlin lay next to Murray and held a sterling spoon to a bruise on her leg to take out the tenderness. We sat on the pine porch, Chisholm's cigar glowing in the dark. We felt full. It was as if we had done something. Later, lying in bed, I was glad I'd stopped to see him. I had needed work and familiar faces around a dinner table. I needed stories that embarrass because they are undeniable, stories that only old friends can tell because only they know them. And it appeared then as though I wouldn't have been able to travel another mile had it not been for these people. I suppose that wasn't true, but it seemed so. 3. Pete Marvin was also Pierangelo Masucci. They were one and the same. Well, almost the same. He said he thought more like an Italian when people called him Masucci. But that didn't happen often now. His brother had changed the name in the late 30s when, as a schoolboy, he tired of teachers fumbling Masucci and kids laughing. Pete said, "If nobody can speak the name, you got no name." He lived on a 75-acre farm high on the glacial hills above Canandaigua Lake. In his garage workshop, he was tinkering with a new Buick he'd just bought for a good figure because the front end had been damaged in a test drive. While barn swallows slid in and out, Pete chewed Winter's cigar clippings and worked on the car. There had been trouble with the dealer in the transaction, and Pete had asked Chisholm, his neighbor, to write a letter of complaint for him. Chisholm had gone into Rochester and turned the project over to me. "Language-wise," Pete said, "if it's writing, I'm not so good." He gave me a pad and pencil. "Who's the letter to?" I asked. "Ralph Nader." It wasn't a joke. So together we wrote the letter, a hot, fuming thing, as Pete wanted. Then we talked and drank lemonade. He and his wife, Pauline, were born in Rochester. Pete in 1910, she in 1914. His mother, Philomena, was born in Naples, Italy, in 1884. The three lived in a 105-year-old farmhouse. Pete and Pauline had moved from Rochester to the New York vineyard country between Cheshire and Naples in the late 40s and rebuilt the big house over the years, tearing down a shed to build a kitchen, installing heat and plumbing. It was an accomplishment, the more so because Pete had walked with crutches since he was a small boy. The carpentry required Pauline to lift, climb, and hold. Pete measured, cut, and drilled holes for her to drive the nails home. But when he put a new roof on the big garage, she would have none of it, and he crawled up and shingled it alone. At the suggestion of his brother-in-law, Pete had moved the family to the farm for a go at raising chicken broilers. "What did I know about chickens?" He bent a thumb and finger to say zero. "So you learn what you want to do." He went to the library to find out how to build a range shelter for poultry. Jeez, the first year the price was $2 a chicken. Good money. I thought we had it made. But the buyers came out and took the best stock and left me the junk. We fed the hell out of the others, fattened them, and sold them door to door for about $3.50 and made a little money. So I bought 700 more. The next year, the price hit bottom. I finally said shit on chickens. In those early years of farming, he and Pauline took jobs in Canandaigua factories to meet the mortgage payments. First, they worked at the Velo King plant making tricycles for Sears Roebuck. Then they worked at the F.A. Smith Company making electric motors. But Pete didn't like working inside, and he couldn't get the noise of punch presses out of his ears. Even in the fields, he heard the presses. In the early 50s, they quit the factory jobs and began farming full-time. They put in a garden and vineyard and grew blackberries and grapes and built up a herd of 14 dairy cows. they stayed with the Holsteins until the 60s. The government started coming around making you put in equipment if you sold your milk. New techniques like keeping the milk away from the air. You had to tube the milk from tits to tank. We couldn't afford nothing like that. We couldn't get a herd big enough to make bulk making pay. Couldn't keep up with regulations. You remember that Butts, that Secretary of Agriculture? He said, get big or get out. We got out. I finally said shit on cows. Pete cursed the Buick. Engineers. $50,000 a year to make things lousy and 5 years in college to learn how to do it. I had a 27 Chevy coupe, old, busted thing with a cracked block. You think we had money to get it welded? We pulled the engine and set it on the kitchen table and filled the crack with solder. Drove it 5 more years. They engineered then. He gave up on the Buick for a while and closed the hood. We tried blackberries, but picking was too hard on the old people and kids horsed around. We paid pickers a dime a quart and sold for 12 cents. Is that profit? A blackberry bush lasted 3 or 4 years after it started bearing. I finally said shit on blackberries. You're down to grapes. Grapes we picked by hand. Now they have a mechanical picker that shakes them off. 5 or 6 acres of grapes in them days gave you a living. 600 plants to an acre. You can't live off them today unless you got 100 acres. 60,000 plants to support a man. My fields have gone back wild like a lot of the other old vineyards. We planted Concords by the thousands. Growers around here used to dig the holes by hand. I couldn't do that, so I used a post-hole digger on the back of the tractor. You know what? People got word of it, and they said, this Pete's got an idea. Did I ever get any money for it? Shit. But that's how they plant grapes today. He looked over the letter to Ralph Nader and said nothing. We raised Concords and sold them to the Widmer and Taylor wineries. Widmer's just on the highway at Naples. Then in the early 70s, Widmer quit buying. They started bringing in California grape juice in tank cars because it was cheaper than buying here. Vineyards went to hell all around. A lot of good stock died out, and growers went to planting peas and beans. Generations of the best rootstock just torn out. A grape root can live 100 years. Then the New York legislature, or somebody, said they couldn't call it New York wine if it was made from California juice. So the winery started buying again from around here. Too late for me. Nitrate and potash for fertilizer got too expensive. I was 66 years old, and I couldn't baby the plants anymore, so I said shit on grapes. But hey, we used to make our own grape juice and wine and pie and jelly. We ate and drank grapes in any way you name. I got a purple gut like Pa. Pete started tinkering with his old Ford tractor. The only modification on it for him was a hand clutch. You gotta get up pretty early in the morning to keep up with those winery boys, he said. During Prohibition, Widmer's sold grape juice to stay in business, but who wanted grape juice? So they put a label on the bottle that said the juice might ferment if it didn't get kept cold. That's upholding the law. As Pauline came out to the workshop, she talked softly in Italian to the swallows. She wanted to show me the garden orchard they had just planted. The trees, cherry, plum, apple, pear, were nothing but fishing poles. I look out kitchen window when I cook and see leaves, she said. Some day, God letting me, I see apples and plums. We walked around to the well, and she pumped up a sample. Taste this water sweet like candy, and tell if this is a good place. Pete said, we play with farming now. I rent the fields to a young guy, nice Italian boy. He's put in kidney beans this year. I wouldn't sell the farm. I wouldn't as long as nobody waves big money in my face. He pointed toward the lake. Good vineyard country. The hills let cold air slide down to the water, and we don't get so many late spring freezes. We used to make our wine, Pauline said. Pete, his father, teached him. Now Pa was a champion winemaker. He learned in Naples, Italy, the old country way. Back in Rochester, he made wine in the basement out of little black Joes. We call them Zinfandels now. Always kept the wine cellar locked and the key around his neck. He'd come upstairs and say, Il vino fa sangue sano. Wine makes good blood. The old man's breakfast was a big glass of red with 2 raw eggs in it. Pete had a long smile, and he smiled often, and always he smiled when he spoke of his father. "You know how we knew when to bung up the bottles, the way we knew the fermenting was finished?" I couldn't guess. "Then you're learning, my friend. This is the old Italiano way. We pulled a penny balloon over the neck of the bottle to keep air and dirt out and let gas escape into the balloon. When the balloon didn't get bigger, we'd start bunging up." "Those darned old days," Pauline said, and she smiled at them. "They're gone, honey." Pete waved a crutch skyward. "My grandfather planted his grapes according to the stars and moon. Now the boys out here plant according to Cornell University." We went in for lunch. Pete poured out two jiggers of Seagram 7 Crown and passed me one. "No good blood in it, only just some heat." Philomena joined us. The conversation covered many things: crops, carpentry, machines, Italy, food. At times, the talk was about someone who had failed a promise or pulled a shenanigan. They condemned the man, then. Pauline made the lunch from what she had taken from her garden and the edges of the field. A salad of dandelion and wild mustard greens, served with olive oil and vinegar, boiled cardoon deep-fried in a garlic egg batter, boiled and sugared rhubarb, and a small piece of fried venison from a quart jar. "Never eaten canned deer," I said.
"Does it taste like more?"
"That's the cardoon."
"And you have some more rhubarbs, too," Pauline said. "You know, we hear about this place called McDonald's. 2 weeks ago, we drive there for a hamburg sandwich."
Her face pinched up.
"Meat was thin like cheesecloth. This is no hamburg sandwich," I say. "This is joke."
Philomena couldn't have the dinner. She took boiled spinach and bread, dipping the bread into the spinach and eating all of it. She had her health, but the hearing wasn't so good now. "She's 94, Pete said.
"I'm a 94.
"I just told him you're 94, Ma.
I was unlucky all my life," she said.
"She came to America when she was 18. Pete spoke in a kind of Bronx accent, his wife and mother with deep Italian accents. Sometimes I ask questions just to hear their words. "When we talk about American things, we speak American. When it's Italian things, we talk Italiano," Pete said. "I don't speak it so good. But Pauline, geez, she really talks the old language. They out-talk me in Italiano, but I take care of them in American." Philomena, whose common name was Fanny, finished her meal and sat back listening as best she could, looking at nothing in particular. Her hands, spotted and veined like moth wings, fluttered up and down from time to time and landed softly on the table, in her lap. I asked her, "Did you like the old days?"
"Ha!" she said. "They think more of horse or jackass than a human person. They never teach me to read." "We women's was brought up to be just like mouse," Pauline whispered. "We was so quiet." "Work all time, because we got to make everything," Philomena said. "Couldn't buy no cookies, no cakes. Got to make it all. Couldn't buy nothing."
"You had two choices for dinner and supper," Pete said. "Pasta fazole or nothing. Every day we ate pasta fazole. Always on the stove, pasta fazole, pasta fazole. Macaroni and beans, shit on it." "You got tired of it?" "What can you do, my friend? We ate poor, lived poor, slept poor." "How do you sleep poor? 5 to a room?"
"My mother, she had 8 children," Pauline said. "They was all delivered by midwife. She go to doctor for first time in her life when she is 65. Poor was not all things bad."
Pauline cleared the table and got the risen dough ready for the oven. Just before she pushed the pan in, she made the sign of the cross and kissed her first two fingers and touched them to the dough. I asked her what it meant.
"I don't know, but my mother used to bless the breads. If she throw the bread away, she kissed it. It was sin to waste."
"Rough living," Pete said. Pauline smiled.
"But life was good. You had your band."
"My band? Hell. The only good thing was eating on Sunday."
"We call Sunday a little special," Pauline said.
"Sunday was spaghetti day. But there were other hard things in Rochester, even if you were born in America, like us. If your name ended in a vowel, you didn't go to college.
What's a vowel got to do with it? Masucci, Zambito, Gambrini, Bassetta. You were Italian, my friend. All they would say to you was, shut up or go to hell.
Polish peoples come in our garden and steal our garlics, Pauline said. We have nothing extra.
Rochester was tough. If you were a German off the boat, you got a good job. Kodak or Bausch & Lomb wanted Germans. They thought just being Kraut made a good worker in lenses and film. But if you were Italian, you got the shovel and pick. No questions asked, no answers given. My brother finally got a job with a master carpenter, but the old man hid the skills from him, afraid the kid would take his trade away.
Work all the time, Philomena said. Work, work.
Work was their god. Pa was a machinist for the Rochester Streetcar Company. The whole family worked. I drove a dump truck to help out.
He was driving the truck when you first find me, Pauline said.
I saw her washing clothes in a tub under a tree. I was hauling dirt in a $125 truck. I had a truck, a straw hat, and a cigar. Big man, you see. I honked, and she smiled, and that was it.
Pete and me, we go to the park. My brother and sister go with us always.
It was courting then, Pete said. Her father, Sam Zambito, he watched and approved everything. No messing around. The old Sicilian, he knows when a pear's ripe it falls to the ground by itself. Pauline grinned at that. But after I married her, Sam encouraged me. Without him, I wouldn't ever got this place. See, he came out here first. He lived up the road, up at the dead end where the undertaker lives now.
The undertaker lives at the dead end?
Hey, Pete said, leave the jokes to me. I'm the 53rd card.
He passed a whiskey. I asked, were you ever bitter about the crutches?
Bitter? Where was time to be bitter?
I prayed for him, Philomena said.
It didn't help, Ma.
Could a doctor have helped?
Who knows? My parents had no money, no education. They believed anything.
I prayed for him. I prayed, yes.
Okay, Ma.
Pete poured himself another.
They wheeled me 2 miles in a kid's wagon one time to see Amy Semple McPherson, the faith healer. I was 7 or 8. We were up on a stage. She made a cross on my forehead in oil, and she looked at me and said, throw away those crutches. Throw them down. I knew I couldn't do it. You think I hadn't tried 1,000 times? Throw away those sticks, boy, she yelled at me. I didn't, though. The audience called out, geez, they were crazy for a miracle.
Pete's mother looked distressed as he told the story.
I prayed for him,
she said quietly.
And they took me to another healer, an Indian, he claimed to be, the 7th son of the 7th son. They got him for fraud, too. Now the Jehovah's Witnesses knock on the door and want to heal me, I tell them, shit on this healing.
We went outside to the edge of the fields. Pete said, with the garden and wild food in the orchard, we got our retirement. There's a grocery in the cellar with what Pauline's put up. We always had our own meat, but we butchered the last deer 1 year ago and the last hog 3 years ago. Now that's finished for us, too.
Pauline pointed to the cardoon growing along the fence and said, God's green earth.
Pete shook his head.
There was a time when we made our own cheese and sold it door to door and grew our own wheat and had it milled over in Pittsford. We took apples down to Canandaigua to get made into cider. We raised ducks and turkeys. Tried them all. Old MacDonald had a farm.
E-I-E-I-O,
Pauline sang.
We never have a sheep's, though. When we have dairy cows, I wash the barn insides every day. You could eat in there, it was so clean. And when Pete drive the tractor, I ride on back behind him, so I can be out of the wind. Where he go and work, I go.
All that stuff is gone, honey.
No, we don't move so good. And I got the sugar.
She means sugar diabetes.
The best was the children's. We have 24 foster children's come live with us since we moved here in 1945. But we never have children's out of us.
Cheaper by the dozen, Pete said.
One time we had 7 all at once. Some had problems, but they were good pups when they got out here. We have a Puerto Rican boy coming back to see us Memorial Day.
Pauline looked at her watch and hurried into the house.
Soap opera, Pete said. I don't care for any of that. I work. What else can you do?
I was born all over again when we came out. I'd be dead now if we didn't move to this place.
He stopped and poked a crutch at some cardoon.
There's one thing, though, I've looked for here. I thought I'd find it.
What's the thing?
I've been put on this land for something, but I don't know what the hell for.
You just told me.
4. I stayed in the old vineyard country 3 days. Chisholm and I talked and worked. I wrote a few letters, cleaned cameras. We ate, we drank some Genesee. We disagreed, agreed, and said where we might be in a year or 10 years and where we wouldn't be if we could help it. My last evening with him, we walked down the road and he pointed out a spring in the hill high above the lake where Indians had camped for many years. Under the grass, big dark rings, the marks of Seneca huts, still remained.
It seems they left nothing behind, he said, as if they never were. But their signature is still here when you know where to look.
He talked angrily about the Sullivan-Clinton campaign George Washington sent through New York in 1779 to punish local Indians for siding with the British and also to clear the region for white settlers. The Iroquois tribes, led by the Onondaga Hiawatha, lived in houses, farmed the land, and by most definitions, were civilized. Yet some settlers found that idea intolerable and saw to the destruction of the Iroquois. To encourage new settlement, the government even gave veterans of the Revolutionary War tracts of Indian land. But most of the soldiers sold it to speculators for a few cents an acre. We turned to head home.
This has been a strange part of the country, Chisholm said.
Something around the lakes brings out the mystical in a person. These counties have been full of prophets, religious zealots, and spiritualists who had hotlines to God, or the dead. Joseph Smith, Jemima Wilkinson, the Fox sisters, there was a pair. They rapped to spirits in seances and got them to tap back. Under investigation later, they admitted making the noises from the other world by cracking their toe joints.
In the moonlight, we walked over an abandoned vineyard. The posts had fallen down and vines inched about for something to crawl up on. One had twisted around a rusting baler, and another climbed a broken plow. We passed a foundation of a barn that had collapsed, a toppled chimney, and a weedy depression where an ice house had stood.
These are all dreams we're walking over, I said.
Chisholm looked at me strangely and went quiet for some time. When he spoke again, it was about the dogs. Afterward, I thought I understood his silence. I had undercut the stone wall we had built, our accomplishment. The wall looked enduring, and it would serve for a while. But there would come a time when it would be a pile of rock to no end. I had undercut the biggest dream of all, the one for permanence. Maybe that's what we really felt in the stones, how man is the tool of his dreams, dreams that rise only to fall back to earth. Wednesday afternoon, I left.
Going?
Chisholm said.
You've got wings on your feet.
I drove up along Canandaigua Lake, past the summer houses of the company men from Kodak and Bausch & Lomb and Xerox, past houses with names like Bida Wee and Summer Days, past the Roseland Amusement Park of Snow Cones and Fudge Ripple, past pink and aquamarine motels, through Canandaigua with its wide main street of brick buildings from another century. At the top of the street, among the Greek Revival houses, stood the old Ontario County Courthouse, nearly as big as a state capitol, where Susan B. Anthony was found guilty of voting. To one side, in the same architectural style, the Masonic Lodge. Chisholm had said the similarity and proximity of the two buildings indicated something about the administration of justice here in the 19th century. It was Western New York where, in the 1820s, A Masonic lodge in Batavia turned down William Morgan for membership, even though he claimed membership in Rochester. He threatened to reveal the highest secrets of the order. The last time a non-Mason saw him alive was in Lewiston. A few days later, Lake Ontario washed up a body that may have been Morgan's. The issue mobilized a group into a political party called the Anti-Masons. That, Chisholm had said, was the power Masons used to have here. 5. Joseph Smith, an 18-year-old with small hands and big feet, a quiet and unlaughing boy, encountered the Angel Moroni, son of Mormon, on a drumlin alongside a little road south of Palmyra in 1827. The road is now New York 21, and the drumlin, a streamlined hump of glacially drifted soil, they call Hill Cumorra. It is not a Mount Sinai or an Ararat, but rather a much humbler thing. Yet apparently of sufficient majesty for angels and God to have chosen it as the place to speak to Smith. There he unearthed the golden plates that he said were the source of the Book of Mormon. With the aid of an ancient pair of optical instruments, the Urim and Thummim, which Smith found with the plates, he was able to translate the revised Egyptian hieroglyphics, although he insisted on dictating his translation to scribes from behind a curtain. I looked at Hill Cumorra and tried to envision it as it was in Smith's day. The Mormons have built a shaft depicting witnesses who attested to the reality of the plates and the heavenly pronouncements, but to my mind, the tower protested too much. Somehow monuments more entomb history than mark it. To see Bunker Hill, in fact Breed's Hill, today, rising unimposingly from the workers' houses, is to put historical imagination to the test, because Bunker Hill now belongs more to a notion of the past than to actuality. Palmyra was a clean town of three-story brick buildings, where I turned east on New York 31 and went down along the route of the Erie Canal, through villages, over fields of deep green, under blooming locust trees, and past barns collapsing next to mobile homes that looked depressingly immobile, yet also impermanent. At Savannah, I found the unmarked road to Conquest, down the highway from Victory, easily enough, but staying on it was another matter. Trying to distinguish the main line from the tributaries by playing compass against the worn yellow stripes was blue roading at its perplexing best. After some miles, I had no idea where I was. I called out to five fellows pouring something into the crankcase of a Trans Am. These were the men who believe in the restorative power of STP, as the Chinese believe in rhinoceros horn. "Is this the road to Conquest?" They answered almost together, "Yes." "Where?" "No." "Conquest?" Then, pleased to be considered authorities on the country, they all came to my window. Each answered the question at length, and sometimes at the same moment as another. They corrected, modified, amplified, clarified, and repeated each other's directions. At last I came to understand nothing. "All right," one said, "here it is. Run this road straight through, and you can't help but miss it." Off I went, hoping Conquest would find me. In the dairy country, chewing Holsteins and Guernseys switched their tails and flicked their skins. On the other side of Johnny Cake Road lay Conquest. Then I began the game again, looking for Cato. Along the roads were cottage industries selling clothesline poles, purple martin houses, potted plants, AKC pups. I stopped for a sandwich in an old hotel in Cato, but the only food was pickled sausage at the bar, so I had sausage with a glass of beer. And that, as it turned out, was dinner. Through the wavy panes of old windows, I could see children standing along the main street, jerking their arms up and down at trucks. Each time a driver pulled on his air horns, the children jumped and cheered. That evening in Cato, it was the only game in town. Just after dusk, I arrived in Central Square and couldn't find a place to park for the night. I finally drove up a quiet side street. In 10 minutes, the police joined me. "What's your business here?" one said. "Got sleepy on the highway." He gave a lengthy explanation about recent burglaries in the neighborhood. "In other words, Missouri, better move tail along." "I'm going to fall asleep at the wheel." "Get a motel," I don't want a motel. I live in the truck. I don't like motels. You've got my license number. I'm not going to pull off a heist now. Can you prove ownership of this vehicle? In irritation, I snapped open my wallet, sending credit cards flying. An older cop, a large pile of beef on the hoof, joined in. What's all the jawing about? His hands were truncheons, itching to clobber something. He wants a place to sleep. Has he got money? Or do we have a vagrant here? He's got money, I said, but he's not going to prove it unless you book him. He just proved his identity and ownership of his vehicle, and that's enough, considering he's broken no law. Go down to the park next to the cemetery, the beef said. You'll be all right there. Is the night shift going to come around and run me off? We are the night shift. We'll keep an eye on you. For whose protection, I didn't know. But I went to the tiny park and pulled up equidistant between home plate and the tombstones. I'd traveled 10,000 miles and had not encountered a single hoodlum, but I'd been taken for one several times. 6. The menu said, check our snowmobile weekend package deal. I skipped it and ordered a standard road breakfast. The shingled cafe, Ben and Bernie's, afforded a broad view of Lake Oneida. The placemats were maps of Italy, and the man beside me ate bagels and cream cheese. No question, this was the Northeast. The Oneida shoreline road was warm, too warm, for May, although maples by the highway had opened to a cooling shade. The perpetual spring I'd been following around the country was about done. On a map, Lake Oneida looks like a sperm whale, and my course that morning was down the spine, from the flukes to the snout. All along the shore, old houses, big houses, were losing to the north climate, and for miles it was a place of sag and dilapidation. The lake once formed a 20-mile link in the Erie Canal, and just east of Oneida, excavation for the waterway began on the 4th of July, 1817. I stopped near the spot at an abandoned section of canal and walked down the old towpath, now a snowmobile trail. The canal, only 4 feet deep in its early years, had become a rank, bosky, froggy trough. But it was that 48 inches of water that did so much to open western New York and the Midwest to settlement and commerce. Clinton's Folly, the popular name for the canal as it was being built, followed the Mohawk Valley, the only natural break at this latitude in the Appalachians. From Lake Erie to the Hudson River, 363 miles, 83 stone locks, 13 aqueducts, the canal moved people and things between the middle of the nation and the ocean. It was this watercourse, as much as anything else, that made New York City the leading Atlantic port. Travelers who had some money could take a packet boat with windows and berths, while poorer immigrants heading into the Midlands rode cheaper and drearier line boats. 10 years after Clinton's Folly opened, the populations of Syracuse, Rochester, and Buffalo increased 300%. The canal, having paid for itself in that decade, had changed the northwest quarter of America. No paltry accomplishment for a scheme that even the visionary Thomas Jefferson saw as a little short of madness. On down the highway to Rome, New York. From its appearance, it could have been London in 1946. The central section gutted, but for a few old brownstone churches, a new shopping mall with triple-tier parking lot, and the National Park Service reconstruction of 18th-century Fort Stanwix, covering several blocks on the east side. While the palisaded fort had been elaborately rebuilt, it did not turn Rome back into a city. And while ribbon development along the highways gave an economic life, it didn't give Rome a center. The place looked as if it had died of heart rot, from the inside out. I went up into the Adirondacks at a point where they form a virtual wall, and ghost dancing labored making the ascent. No sun in the forest and 12 degrees cooler. The ancient Adirondack Mountains are much older than the old Appalachians they merge with. Consequently, they tend toward roundness with few sharp outcroppings. Adirondack, bark eaters, was a contemptuous epithet Mohawks gave to some degenerated tribe so poor it had to eat trees. I bought gas in Alder Creek and asked the pump man what winter was like in the mountains. This, he said, and held up the stump of a little finger, Frostbite. Snowfall of 142 inches last year. 45 below. Wind chill 70 below. That's what we call winter. The forest became heavier, sky darker, mountains higher, settlements farther apart. What few people were here, the black flies and weather kept indoors that day. Low clouds sailed around under a high overcast and broke up like schooners on the summits. Although moose and caribou disappeared long ago, I was at the heart of a great wilderness second only to the Northwoods of Maine in the eastern United States. An occasional woodsy gift shop or burger stand built like a chalet did not prevent the forest from being pervasive, ominous, and forbidding. Nor did they quiet the strange cries of birds from the dark hemlock. Then a cold rain blew down, turned to hail, then eased to a drizzly fog. It was early afternoon, yet headlights vanished after 20 yards, as if the damp extinguished the beams. Birch, alder, conifers, nothing but trees and water and fog for miles. East of the village of Blue Mountain Lake, dominated by a bluish hump of the Adirondacks, the road descended to a small building, part house, part tavern, snugged against a wooded hill and surrounded by vaporous mountains. The mist glowed orange from a neon beer sign. The building, white clapboard trimmed in red with a silvery corrugated tin roof, was the Forest House Lodge. In fact, it wasn't a lodge, but something even better, an antique roadhouse. The roadhouse, institution and word, has nearly disappeared from America. I ate a ham and cheese sandwich and drank Genesee cream ale. The pallid barmaid talked quietly to an old woman. When there would come a deep rumble of thunder, the women paused in conversation. There were no other sounds, no others about. The room was almost entirely of pine. Immaculately scrubbed, hand-polished pine, gleaming like lacquerware. Each tabletop, each wall, every stool and bench shone warmly in the soft incandescent light, and bottles of rum and brandy and whiskey glowed from within. It was as if the faded woman had given her life to buffing everything to a soft luster and, in doing so, lost her own. Across from a photograph of an awakened hibernating bear hung an 1885 picture of the first Forest House Lodge, when it was a stage stop. The present building, dating from the 30s, seemed to have absorbed the continuum of history. Every so often a logging truck hissed wetly down the highway and rolled the mists before they settled in once more against the polished windows. I sat a long time in an event of no significance beyond simple joy. It lacked only the dimension of sharing. A young man and woman came in carrying a tension as though an unexploded grenade had just dropped between them. He was a swelling of veins across the forehead and his speech a gnashing of teeth, but she was a light and airy woman, one who would move easily in loving. I was grateful for the company and forced a conversation about the Adirondacks that I ended up turning into an Isaac Walton League lecture. The man said, "Wilderness? It's all a crock now. I rafted the Blue Nile in Ethiopia 3 years ago. After a couple of days, we got into country where the natives dressed like the old pictures you see, men almost naked carrying spears, women bare from the waist up, you know, darkest Africa. I was taking pictures when a girl wearing a necklace made out of the cap of a big pen held out her arm. She had a broken Timex on. She said, 'No tik tik.' That almost ruined the trip. It's the same here, a boot print on every square yard of Adirondacks. Wilderness doesn't mean untouched. Then it doesn't mean anything worth anything." If you knew a place that had never been walked over by civilized man, would you stay out of it? I would. Of course I would. "You wouldn't either," the woman said. "You'd walk every foot of it, and brag about your experience and refuse to tell anyone else where it was." "That's it," he said. "Get your coat." 7. Our beginnings do not foreshadow our ends, if one judges by the Hudson River. A few miles east of the Bad Luck Ponds, the Hudson came down between the ridges to race alongside Route 28. It was a mountain stream, clear, cold, shallow, noisy. a few miles from its source in Lake Tear in the Clouds, a mile up on Mount Marcy. The Indian name for the mountain is better, Tahawus, Cloud Splitter. And 300 river miles from the 1,000 oily piers of Hoboken, Weehawken, and Manhattan. Here, it was a canoer's watercourse. Above the Little Hudson, spumes of mist rose from the mountains like campfire smoke. Route 8 dropped out of the Adirondacks to Lake George, the way lined with resort homes and summer camps that advertise in the back pages of the New York Times Magazine. At Hague, I turned north and followed the water up a narrow valley to Ticonderoga and cut through town to the shore of Lake Champlain, where, under the dark brow of the fort built by the British against French and Indian raids, I waited for the ferry. A ferry, interrupted off and on only during the Revolutionary War, had crossed the long lake at this narrow point since the 1740s. The boat of 1759, large enough to carry a stagecoach, had a sail, but on windless days, boatmen walked the length of it and pushed with a single 30-foot oar. After Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold captured Fort Ticonderoga in 1775, the crossing became a critical link in holding the northwestern portion of the colonies, even though Redcoats recaptured the fort and ferry 2 years later, before it came again into American hands. When the British finally left after two wars, they returned as tourists. One, James Buckingham, wrote in 1838, "We descended to the ferry across Lake Champlain, where we passed over in one of the rudest boats I had ever seen. It was little more than an oblong trough. With single sail, the helmsman steering with a long oar, we soon crossed the lake and landed at the station of Shoreham." Almost a century and a half later, I made the same crossing with only a few technological changes here and there. The sail and oarsmen had given way to a modified Navy surplus landing craft attached to a cargo barge. On the other bank, the old stone house that Buckingham had passed, built in 1823 of big blocks dragged across the frozen lake from ruined Fort Ticonderoga, still stood, although now an antique shop. The storm blew on west, and a soft amber light fell over Vermont to give the rise of wet fields deep relief and color. Through the villages of Orwell, Sudbury, and Goshen Corners, past the old groceries with Salada Tea lettered in gold on front windows, and into the Green Mountains, which, some say, Vermont means in French, despite cynical literalists who insist on Worm Mountain. The White River led through Highlands to Route 12. Before realizing it, I was nearly across the narrow state. I drove past the Delectable Mountains, from Pilgrim's Progress, to a village surrounded on all sides by still more mountains and opened only by two rocky brooks. It looked like the set for an Andy Hardy movie, things quaint in the manner of Norman Rockwell. A small green, encircled by Georgian and federal houses with white picket fences and hitching posts, joined the town center of 2- and 3-story granite buildings, each with many muntined windows. Around the green, along the pickets, lilacs and apple trees blossomed. Maybe the town wasn't the prettiest village in America, but if the townspeople wanted to make the claim, I wouldn't have disputed them. It was Woodstock, Vermont. The streets spread from the green into wrenching twists that defied even compass reckoning as they played between Mount Tom and Mount Peg and between the Ottauquechee River and Kedron Brook. There wasn't much level ground in the dell, so the old firehouse hung over the brook, and another building stuck a foundation corner into the water. In spite of its smallness, the town had 7 bridges, one of them a fine covered structure. Most of the big elms were gone, but by intermixing species, the town still retained tall maples, which prevented the barrenness of other New England villages that have lost elms. Although the current population of 1,200 was the largest ever, the town once had a medical school and 5 newspapers. In those early days, citizens manufactured combs, hautboy reeds, Rumsford fire doors, pianofortes, brandy, and pottery. Today, except for a small ski lift assembly plant, Woodstock was a citizenry of clerks. The shop windows displayed Vermont cheese, maple candy, maple syrup, hand-painted wallpaper, Williamsburg reproductions, Hickey Freeman suits, period furniture, early ironwork, primitives, pewterware, Chinese export porcelain, English antiques, Izod pullovers, new wooden toys, antique dolls, tinware, kitchen collectibles, old prints of grouse, brass candlesticks, and copper pots. There were inns, restaurants, and a dozen real estate offices. Outsiders own half of the residential and agricultural land in Vermont. About the mountains were ski slopes and hiking and horse trails, and in the south end of the valley, tennis courts, a skating rink, and a golf course. In other words, the village lived by the tourist, the well-heeled tourist. But few places in the country fused tourism and town life so well. In Woodstock, they were parts of the whole. Any New England town worth its colonial salt has at least one bell cast in Paul Revere's foundry. Like a DAR certificate, it's a touchstone of authenticity. Here, they boasted of four. Yet things were not always so civilized in Woodstock. The first white man to see the site, Ensign Richardson, wrote in 1761 that the Dingle was a spruce hurricane, unfit for habitation other than by Indians. But settlers came anyway, and cut out a green for grazing, and put up stocks and a whipping post, and cleared the lower hills for raising merino sheep. Now the sheep were gone, and the forest had taken back the mountains. Gone, too, was any indication of where on the green lies buried the boiled heart of a child thought to be a vampire. Ensign Richardson's view notwithstanding, the town had been blessed with its wooded setting and the resources around it. From Massachusetts and Connecticut, the first settlers brought along an established culture because the remoteness of the village forced them to grow and manufacture most of their necessities. But after the railroad came through, they began losing their self-sufficiency and depended more and more on goods made elsewhere, and the little independent industries disappeared. Then the railroad started carrying in people looking for spruce hurricanes. Upland game bird shooters, deer hunters, trout fishermen, horsemen, skiers. The first ski tow in the country was on Old Man Gilbert's farm outside of town. And hikers following the Appalachian Trail, which passes just to the north. And still more. Golfers, tennis players, summer camp children, students for the equestrian and photographic country schools. And shoppers. A Chamber of Commerce flyer claimed that the citizens had zealously guided Woodstock's development and growth past the hazards of change that overtook much of the country. Perhaps, at least for now, that was true. Indeed, the town was free of Golden Arch strip development and shopping centers. One 19th-century textile mill had been remodeled into a shopping arcade. And the core of the village remained where it has always been, on the green. At night, when automobiles left the streets, Woodstock had the appearance of another century, because in place of the old businesses that died, the hatter, baker, saddler, tinsmith, fuller, foundryman, wheelwright, miller, wainwright, new businesses had come to use the old buildings in new ways, so that Woodstock wasn't a restoration or even a renovation, but rather a town, like the best English villages, with a continuous and evident past. The careful Yankees, overseeing both their past and their future, managed to lure a class of vacationers who came to stay for a week or a month, and they came with money, although Woodstock wasn't noticeably more expensive than a gimcrack tourist dive. If the village had a fault, it lay in both a hubris about its picturesqueness and in its visitors with new money and new facades. While I walked the streets, I had the sense that the men, still wearing their club ties, had sung in collegiate glee clubs, and that the women attended colleges where one's serviette was kept in a napkin cubby. 8. If you keep a mental list of things in America that you can kiss goodbye, add the tourist home to it. As an institution, it isn't extinct, but nearly so, thanks to the insistence of the American vacationer for starburst-in-the-sky motels. You might as well ask him to share his toothbrush as his bathroom. Yet a proper tourist home is a third the expense and twice as clean as any cell block motel. It can be like staying with grandmother. In Woodstock, I took lodgings in the Bagley Tourist Home, a tall frame house on a hill with a high view of the Ottoquechee and the Green Mountains. an armoire, and spool spindle bed filled most of the wallpapered room. At the window, an apple tree sprinkled petals against the screen. The bathroom, a clean and flowery pink place, was down the hall. Raymond Bagley was a retired machinist, and his wife a former schoolteacher, who managed things and sold jams and jellies. For a time I thought the quaintness might overwhelm me, but as I sat talking with the Bagleys on the front porch glider, the feeling passed. Much of what I learned about Woodstock came during two evenings on the porch. He and his wife both grew up in Woodstock. Unlike some of the villagers, many from other states, the Bagleys showed no animosity toward Flatlanders, anyone from outside the Green or White Mountains, who kept the town prosperous. After sunset, I went down to the village for dinner at Bentley's, a place, the menu said, with the dignity of old wood and lush tropical plants. The diners wore heels and von Furstenberg signature dresses, or plaid shirts and L.L. Bean hiking boots. The men had pointy, thrusty names like Dirk and Derek and Pike. I heard conversations about Grand Marnier crepes and glacé fruit and the problems of paying for a daughter's ballet lessons. An engaged couple dithered over whether to polish their shoe soles for the wedding. After all, they would kneel in front of the congregation. Because I'd never eaten a shad roe omelet before, I ordered one, figuring I could write it off to experience. But I almost ordered a second. Around and up and down, I walked through town and watched Kedron Brook have its go at the rocks. The splashing and row gave me a thirst, so I went to the Woodstock Inn, a big, posh place of high-polished maintenance with an 18-hole putting green off the garden entrance. Lawrence Rockefeller, who married a local woman and still helicoptered in to relax, owned the inn. Cars parked in front were either elaborate hood ornament models or Saabs, the Volkswagen of the Ivy League. On a BMW was a bumper sticker, Polo et Skidmore. On a Mercedes, a vanity license plate, Style. Throughout, I saw a compulsion toward panache, a thing these people needed as the peacock needs its iridescent plumes. In the piney tap room, I sat near a table of two men and their wives, who wore the colors for that spring, pink and Kelly green, touched up with white. The women were in perfect trim like mortuary lawns, and the husbands wore clothes for the man who knows where he's going. They drank cranberry liqueur and Harvey's Bristol Cream with creme. The conversation was about suitable gifts to take the children at home with grandmothers. The decision: volleyballs for the boys, stuffed kangaroos for the girls, brandied apricot cakes for grandmothers. I wondered what the boys were doing at Sonny's place in Dime Box, Texas. 9. The dreams were the kind I would have welcomed the police to rouse me from. Twisted distortions of fact and desire, all turning on the Cherokee offering a new marriage. At last I woke to find myself alone in the wallpapered tourist room. The desolation seemed to have velocity. It hit so hard. I poured a whiskey, watched apple petals tap the screen, and waited out the night. I spent the day on Mount Tom. Had I owned a ghost shirt, I'd have danced madly all over that mountain. Instead, I tried to keep from looking inward, tried to reach outward. But, as Black Elk says, certain things among the shadows of a man's life do not have to be remembered. They remember themselves. By evening, my judgment had given way, and I called home. I was talking fast, talking, trying to find where we stood, how our chances were. She talked. No matter how we tried, our words, confounded, ran athwart. And, as usual, we ended up at cross purposes. Neither of us knew where to go from there. Nothing to do but hang up. When I put the receiver down and heard the line ding dead, I tried to excuse the failure by thinking that nothing ever works out over a telephone. The door of the booth stuck, and I went into a rage, slamming the thing, yelling. People looked around. I went off waiting for insight, but all I got was desolation again. Black Elk, on seeing his people on the blue road, I did not know then how much was ended. 10. Some men take their broken marriages to church basement workshops. I took mine to the highways and attempted to tuck it away for nearly 11